Hi, everybody. We want to thank our sponsor, Legion M. They are a wonderful company. We love working with them. You can go to their website, Legion M. They're also on all the various socials. They do really fun meetups. You can talk to directors. You can become a part of the projects they choose. They even have a program right now where you can help them find great movies to support. So go to their website to learn more. We also want to remind you that we have a Patreon that we call Maltreon. You can join us. We have $3, $5, $10, $20 options. You can get newsletters from my dad, all kinds of neat stuff behind the scenes. Hang out with us, learn about who our guests are before anybody else, and listen to the podcast before anybody else. Go to patreon.com/maltononmovies for more information.
That's patreon.com/maltononmovies.
Hi, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
You're listening to Maltin on Movies. And our guest today has been involved in some movies.
And some books.
And a handful of movies, relatively speaking, and a library full of books, or perhaps a playroom full of books, or perhaps...
A wall.
I have a wall of books. Yeah.
You do.
Ever expanding wall, I assume.
We keep going.
All right. Yes. So our guest is R.L. Stine.
Known to folks like my dad as Bob.
Tell that story.
Known to everyone.
Yeah.
No one ever called me R.L. in my life.
No.
I've always just been Bob.
So the first time that I got to meet you was one of our favorite events and something that I look forward to. It's one of the things that COVID has stolen from us. The LA Times Festival of Books. I was 11 years old, and it was one of my favorite things that we would do every single year, because when you have an author for a father, you get real excited about book fairs. And we were there, and we were in the green room, and my dad introduces me to his old friend Bob Stine. And oh, we know each other from New York and publishing and this and that, and I met you and you were lovely, of course. And when you left, my dad goes, yeah, that's R.L. Stine. And I about punched him in the face, because I said, you did, Bob Leonard?
So you didn't know who you were talking to.
I just knew you were a very nice man who'd known my dad for a very long time.
Oh, that's funny. I love that book festival. I really miss it.
Me too.
Yeah, we
too.
Miss it really. the way it was. And they've tried real hard to keep it alive, and they've moved it from one college campus, UCLA,
to USC. Another
one, USC.
Yes. It's a little cramped at USC. It wasn't quite the same.
No, it's
downtown.
No.
But
UCLA
it was still
is
a great book festival. Really nice book festival.
Yes, it is. And in the early days, when Jesse came with me, that green room was pretty extraordinary, because there was Ray Bradbury, and there was Harlan Ellison, and just a panoply of notable authors. And you.
Yes. Well, thank you. No, well, they were getting 300 authors for a weekend.
Oh, yeah.
That's a lot, 300.
It is.
It was incredible, and it was exciting.
And the attendance was pretty strong.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, right. Did you ever go to the Tucson Book Festival?
No.
That's a really lovely one, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's heartening to know that not only that there are still book festivals, but there are still books.
Yes, right.
There are human beings reading those books.
There are. Yeah, more than you would think.
Yeah, exactly. More than you would think.
But that's the thing is that you are a part of millions upon millions of children's memories. I remember when my school started to allow us to do book reports on your books, because initially they said, no, you got to read, you know, this and this and this. And finally they gave in because everybody was reading Goosebumps. And they let us start
we
liked
using that.
Those.
When my son was in fifth grade, summer came, and the teacher passed out the summer reading list. And she said, and I don't want anyone reading R.L. Stine this summer. And he was sitting there. What was he supposed to do? Right.
Yeah, right.
I don't want anyone reading him. They got tired of all the Goosebumps book reports.
I mean,
those books are too easy to read.
Yeah, right. How dare you? How dare you make books that children
and of course,
enjoy?
You know my son's claim to fame.
No.
I mean, talking about being an author's daughter, my son, his claim to fame is that he never read one of my books.
I love it.
Never.
I love it.
Not a single Goosebumps book. Just to make me nuts.
Are you sure he's not lying?
No. See, that's what a nice person says. But no, he knew how to make me crazy. Mm-hmm. He wouldn't read them. My son read only Garfield comics his whole childhood.
That's so funny.
That's all he read. He had all the collections. And he read Garfield, every night, Garfield. And then he went off to college and he was an English major.
That's...
Go figure, right?
I love it.
Man. Well, at least he was reading the work of another Midwesterner.
Right.
Yes. Well, that's true. That's true. No, I even put him in a book. I figured he might read it. And I put him in a Fear Street book called Goodnight Kiss. And he didn't read that one either. And in the very last paragraph of that book, he gets bit in the neck by a vampire. I paid him back.
I mean, I feel like it's therapy, you know?
Yeah,
it's a healthy release.
Yes, it was.
But I was going to say, when you got into Fear Street, I was a teenager when I started reading the Fear Street books, and they made you feel very grown up. Very grown up at 14.
Well, you know, Fear Street came first, you know. I was doing those teen books first.
Yep.
We were killing off a lot of teenagers. And then my editors came to me and they said, you know, we should try a scary series for younger kids. And this is the kind of businessman I am. I didn't want to do it. I didn't want to do Goosebumps. Because I thought it would mess up my Fear Street audience.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. The older audience. And I fought them. I didn't want to do it. Can you imagine? And then finally I said, all right, we'll try two or three of them. And next year is the 30th year of Goosebumps.
Jeez.
Man. 30 years of this stuff.
How many are there?
Oh, I lost count. I don't know. I don't know. 150 something. Yeah. I don't know. You know, there are only six plots, right?
Right.
Yeah. Somehow I've gotten away. No one's noticed.
Well, but again, that's the thing is that it's, you know, again, if you're a certain age, everyone read them. And if say the name R.L. Stein, they go, oh, yeah, of course. Of course I did.
Yeah, we love the 90s.
Right.
Yeah. Those are the good days.
but it's a big deal when you can connect with an audience like that, because you know,
it was amazing luck. That's what it was. It was luck.
Well, we're going to have you tell that saga. We're going to ask you to tell that saga. But let's rewind and start at the very beginning, as they say.
Yeah.
You
guys have known each other 40 something years.
Oh, I don't know. When did you live on 79th Street?
Well, when we got married, we moved into that brand new apartment building.
1975.
March of 1975. And then 75. In time, we met your brother.
He was in the same building.
In the same building with his wife, Megan.
Yeah.
Bill and Megan. And we became friendly. And then eventually, through them, we met you and your wife, Jane.
Yes.
And so that's a while ago. We're married 46 years.
I've got you beat. I'm 52 years.
Wow.
We have you beat. But as I say, when anyone asks us how long we've been married, I always say 12 wonderful years.
That's right.
Right? Jane hates that joke. Hates it.
Alice used to hate that. It's from Henny Youngman.
Is it
10 of the most wonderful years of my life? and yeah, she really disliked my telling that joke.
My mom just responded. She just come into the room.
And
Mama,
and,
we're talking to Bob Stein, please.
Oh, Bob Stein.
This very important.
And it doesn't
my mom wants to say
hi. Hi, there you are.
Hey, how are you doing, sir?
And I can good. See Jane in the corner.
Oh, is she
Where
hiding?
Is Jane? Is Jane's hiding in the corner.
Isn't Where are that you? Sad?
She's in God. The chair. She knows not to get on screen.
Ah, well. All
right. Sometimes the dog starts barking and she has to carry him away.
Oh, please. We've got two dogs in the room. We've got one Alice.
Yeah.
Just
She's
for
coming.
A second. Hello. I'm sorry to interfere. I realize you guys are doing.
So we were just getting into Mama. You guys met.
Yes, we did.
40 something years ago.
Well, we've been married.
He and Jane have you beat. They're married 52 years.
How's it going?
It's promising. Very promising.
Yeah. Going well so far.
Well, I'm trying to give Leonard a chance. You know what I mean?
Yeah. If it works That's out, kind.
If not,
That's very
this
kind.
Is Hollywood. It doesn't have to, you know. Anyway, Bob, it's lovely to see you. And I'm so glad that you know, things are working out for you as a writer.
Things are coming along.
So let's continue with our rewinding now.
Yeah. All right. If you insist.
You were born in a suburb of Columbus, Ohio.
Bexley, Ohio.
Mm-hmm. And what is Bexley known for?
Nothing.
Well, now it's known as York.
No, you've stumped me. Yes, it's known for being a little suburb in the middle of Columbus. It's known for mainly by me. It's known for pizza.
Ah.
Uh-huh. Rubino's Pizza.
In our family, that's very important.
Yeah, well, that was our high school hangout, Rubino's Pizza on Main Street. And I actually, this is Columbus, Ohio pizza. I actually have Rubino's Pizza in my freezer in New York. Mm. They overnight it to me.
Oh, I love it.
Great.
Yeah. And even Jane, who is a lifelong New Yorker, admits that Ohio pizza is good.
Oh.
Yeah.
Controversial.
Every town has to have something, right?
Of course.
Right.
Now, you and I have at least one thing in common. We both drew comic strips when we were very young. What sparked that in you?
A kid in fourth grade brought in little comic books, little stapled together that his father had done. And they were about football, little football comic books that his father had done. And I thought, I could do that. That looks really cool. That actually, you know, was my ambition for a long time, was to be a comic book illustrator.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this character, Super Stooge. He was a real dumb superhero. And I would draw these comics. And I was a very shy kid, very shy. And I would bring them into school and pass them around to the other kids to get attention, you know. And I would pass them around and they would look at my comics and they'd say, well, Bob, Your drawing sucks. You can't draw. And then I'd look at everyone else's drawing. They were right. I couldn't draw. Absolutely couldn't.
Well, you Terrible. Tried.
Yeah. So that's why, you know, if I could draw, why would I write all these books? Right? What inspired you, Leonard? Why did you start doing comics?
Oh, because, well, I did a comics a comic book or two or three, but like you, my skills were somewhat lacking. The enthusiasm was there, but the execution was not as I would have had it. So I started trying to do panel cartoons, mm-hmm. the ones I saw in the Saturday Evening Post and the New Yorker at the public library.
And Collier's.
And I actually have rejection slips from both of those magazines because there was a book called Drawing and Selling Cartoons by Jack Marco, and I followed his instructions to the letter, send a self-addressed stamped envelope, blah blah blah, and in due course I got my well-deserved rejection slips.
Don't you think it's so mysterious that some people can draw and some can't? That there's some connection between the hand and the eye that some people have and some people don't. And either you can draw or you can't draw.
Yeah, I love to draw. I really enjoy it. I'm just not very good at it.
Well, it's very mysterious.
Yeah.
Why some, you know, some people can do it. Now, James McMullen is a friend of ours. He does all the posters for Lincoln Center Theater, all those amazing posters.
Sure.
Jim claims that he can teach anyone to draw, but I don't believe him.
Well, do you remember John Nagy?
Yes.
Early television, learned to draw.
Yes,
John
I do.
Nagy.
Yes.
And gosh, I got that home kit and I followed him slavishly and my stuff still looked like hell. there was one of his images I remember was a snow-covered mailbox in a wintry landscape.
Right.
And when he did it, it really looked like snow was sitting on that metal mailbox. And when I did it, just looked like lumps. So
yeah,
I quickly assessed my talent or lack of and started writing. And
well, right.
You
we
did.
Both
you retreated
did.
To writing.
Yeah, we both did. Well, people always ask me, did you have a teacher who encouraged you? Encouraged you to write? And of course, the correct answer is yes, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
You don't ever tell the truth. The truth is that, you know, I would do these little comics and little joke magazines and bring them in all the time. And my teachers begged me to stop. They begged me, Bob, please don't do this anymore. Please don't bring these in. And I honestly think if they hadn't asked me to stop, I might have stopped and not done it.
But just
when you're a kid,
them.
you get horrible advice when you're a kid.
Yeah.
You know, my parents didn't understand. I was in my room. I'm 9 years old. I'm in my room typing all afternoon. I'm typing. And my mom would stand outside my door. She'd say, "What's wrong with you? Go outside and play."
Yes.
Go outside.
It's a beautiful day outside.
Yes, right. Go out. The worst advice I ever got: stop typing and go outside and play. Right? I just say, yeah, type, type, type. It's boring out there.
You're
too
right.
Boring out there.
Yeah.
Just typing.
Well, I asked my dad what got him into movies and all of that stuff. And he said, I was terrible at sports. I said, that's a solid reasoning.
Yeah. Leonard and I have a lot in common.
He goes, it was indoors. It was inside. I didn't want to go outside.
Yeah,
what kind of typewriter did you begin on?
I had, for my bar mitzvah, I got this big black stand-up Royal typewriter.
Mm-hmm.
Fancy.
Heavy, weighed a ton.
Mm-hmm. And of course, we must explain to the tiny tots in the audience that in those days, these were what they call manual typewriters.
Listen, I sell more typewriters now than anyone in America. This is true. It's embarrassing too. In the Goosebumps movie, Jack Black played me. And in the film, he wrote his books, me. I wrote my books on a typewriter. And it plays a big part in the story.
Mm-hmm.
And Jack is there typing, typing, typing. And now I get on Twitter, I get from parents, my son wants to be like you. What kind of typewriter do you use? I need to buy him a typewriter. And they send me photos of these kids who are writing on typewriters now.
Amazing.
Because they saw it in the movie. I thought, don't buy him a typewriter. What's he going to do with a typewriter? And there's these kids sitting there with typewriters.
I was heartbroken when they made me stop. I had a typewriter till fourth grade, and then our school started requiring you to use computers.
Right.
I was really sad because I liked the typewriters.
Well, Leonard, how many books do we write on typewriters?
Oh, God.
How many?
As of today, none.
Never?
No, of course.
My first
manuscripts are in fact typed. And I was embarrassed to turn in, like if I did a freelance article for a magazine, I would be embarrassed to turn in a page of type with crossouts and carotid in corrections. I could do a few on a page, but if it started looking a little messy, I was very self-conscious and I would retype the whole page.
Well, how did we revise? How did we ever revise on a typewriter?
I don't know.
It's impossible.
Slowly is how you revised.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
So when did you start working at Scholastic?
1 week before Christmas, 1968. I started as assistant editor of Junior Scholastic Magazine.
Wow.
And I was there for 1 week, and they came around with a cart with Christmas bonuses and handed me an envelope. It had $15 in it. And I thought, wow, I've only been here 1 week and I get a $15 Christmas bonus. I can't wait till next year. And next Christmas came around, I got $15. Everyone got $15.
And so a career was born, but in the wrong direction.
Yeah, I was doing history and geography.
Oh boy.
Oh man.
Oh, I hated doing research. I've never done research. I don't like research. So one issue of Junior Scholastic, I got the capital of Brazil wrong. You know, trying to write from memory. Yeah.
Again, we have to explain because we do have to explain.
Yeah.
There was no such thing as the internet.
Yes, so right.
When you use the term doing research.
But like, how did you look things up?
That would indicate going to a library and finding books. Yeah. Or guides or atlases any number.
Right, articles.
Yeah. So
there was a cartoon. I don't remember where it was. It's a boy in a library and he's talking to the librarian behind her desk. And behind the desk is a complete set of Encyclopedia Britannica.
Ah, mm-hmm. Yes.
And the boy says, wow, you mean they printed it out?
That's good.
That is funny depressing.
It's a great cartoon.
That is equal parts hilarious and depressing.
Yeah, I guess it is.
We got the internet started to become a thing when I was in sixth grade. And so my generation, I'm 35 now, my generation is the one that started to have to do both. Where, and our teachers would have to be very specific. You were only allowed to include one internet resource. The others still had to come from the library.
Yeah.
You still had to write, you know, a bibliography and do this and this. And I've said to my dad before, I don't know what kids have to do now. I have no idea how it works.
Right. All they do is Wikipedia.
Yeah. Oh, God help us.
Yeah.
That's it. That's all they do. Google and Wikipedia.
Yeah.
No.
What more do you need?
Your guide to the world.
Well, in that case, you could put whatever capital you want for Brazil.
I could.
Just change it on Wikipedia. It'd be fine.
Now, I want to ask about your joke books. When did you learn that you could write jokes?
No, I was always funny. It's all the only thing I ever cared about. I mean, I never planned to be scary. I was always just funny. And in school, I'm always a smart aleck, disrupting the class, making jokes. I thought I was hilarious as a kid. And so I always planned to be funny. I went to New York after I graduated from Ohio State. I was the editor of the humor magazine at Ohio State for 3 years. That's all I did in college. Mm-hmm. I hardly ever went to class. I just did this humor magazine. In those days, every college had a humor magazine. They don't anymore. And I went to New York to find jobs writing funny magazines, I tried to write funny adult novels without much success. And that's all I cared about. So at Scholastic, my wife, became editor of a magazine called Dynamite. which was an enormously popular kids magazine in the 70s and 80s.
I remember.
It was the biggest thing at Scholastic. It was huge. It was a big cash cow for them, brought in millions of dollars. And her magazine was so successful, they let me have a humor magazine. Just because of her success. They didn't really want a humor magazine, but they did. And I did this magazine, Bananas, at Scholastic, which was sold through Scholastic book clubs. It was Mad Magazine, all in color. Mm-hmm. And I did that for 10 years. And while I was doing it, an editor over at, I forget the publisher now, Follett. No, maybe Dutton. The editor at Dutton said, "Oh, I love your magazine. I bet you could write funny kids books. Why don't we get together and you could write funny kids books?" So that's how I got started writing joke books and writing kids books. Mm. But how lucky. I mean, I can't really talk to young writers about all the struggles, the struggles of getting rejected and rejected, because she called me, I always say, well, get a job in publishing and you'll meet a lot of editors. They'll be your friends and then they'll call you. But, how lucky is that not to go through? There's one person luckier than me. I've done a couple books with Mark Brown. Mark does Arthur the Aardvark.
Yep.
Those books. And it's the longest running kids animated TV series in history, Arthur, on PBS. Mark created Arthur right after college.
Hmm.
It's the only thing he's ever done. Talk about no struggle, nothing. There it was, Arthur. He's out of school and he's doing Arthur.
Amazing.
And he made a fortune.
Hmm. Now you were born in 1943, which I mention only because
you're younger.
Well, my mom's 43 as well. My mom's 1943 too.
Yeah.
Well, no, I don't do it to boast in any way. I do it to create a timeline in my own mind of what your influences were. What were you reading? What were you listening to on radio? And then eventually watching on television?
We didn't have television until I was 9. Mm-hmm. Try telling that to a kid today. Right?
Yep.
I was in a classroom once and a kid raised his hand. And he said, "Did you do home videos when you were a kid?"
Oh, God.
And it's a tip of my tongue to say we only had radio. But that's horrible. You can't do that. I listened to all the mystery shows on radio and all the comedy shows. I loved Duffy's Tavern and Fibber McGee and Molly, all the great comedy shows. Mm-hmm. Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy, Mortimer Snerd was a big influence on me.
Ah.
I always loved stupidity, humor, always. I mean, nothing makes me laugh harder than real stupid stuff. And Mortimer Snerd, he was like, "How did you get so stupid, Mortimer? I went to night school." that kind of joke. And later, there was this comedy team in New York, Bob and Ray.
Ah.
And I was obsessed with them.
Well, and properly so.
Yes. I just thought they were amazingly witty. And as a kid, and I would run home from school in the afternoon, and we had this old console radio, and I would try, if I got just the right way, if I tuned it just perfectly, I could pick up CKLW in Windsor, Ontario, and I could hear the Bob and Ray show every afternoon after school. It was, that was like really big deal, big important thing. As far as books, I didn't read books till I was 9 or 10. I only read comic books.
Mm-hmm.
I was a real comic book freak. And of course, when I was a kid, the wonderful EC horror comics, Tales from the Crypt and The Vault of Horror, The Witch's Cauldron, those comics were amazing. Anyway, I loved these comic books and I wasn't allowed to have them at home. I bought a couple of them you know, comics were, I had a couple dimes and I bought two comics, brought them home. My mom stopped me at the door. She said, well, you can't have these. They're trash. You can't have them. And so the barbershop had a big stack of horror comics. Mm-hmm. And this is true. Every Saturday morning, I'd go to the barbershop and get a haircut so that I could read these comic books. I had less hair when I was a kid than I do now. It's hard to believe. And I just loved them. They were a very big influence on me because, first of all, the amazing art. The art was wonderful. And they were gruesome, horrible, bloody comics and all had a funny twist ending. Every story had a funny twist at the end. That's like a big deal to me.
Well, they were very influential on Stephen King.
Yes.
And on many, many others of our ilk, right. Our age bracket.
Yes, true. And Mad comics, too. Mad was a comic book. When I first started reading Mad, I thought it was the funniest thing I'd ever seen. You know,
it was. And,
yeah, it was, you know, it taught you how to be cynical.
Yes.
We didn't know how to be cynical till Mad came along.
It's been said that it really had a surprisingly subversive tone for something that was essentially aimed at kids.
Yes, right. It's so sad that there is no Mad. We have this enormous country and we have no humor magazine.
Yeah.
Not a single humor magazine in the country. It's really hard to believe. It's not, you know, we're not in a fun zone.
No.
We really aren't.
And we could use a good humor magazine.
We could, except that everyone would be offended.
Yes,
yeah,
of
that's
course.
The problem.
No, everyone's offended by everything now. You honestly, you cannot tell any kind of joke or anything without somebody being offended and starting a petition.
Going back to your Mortimer Snerd comment reminds me, I saw the great French filmmaker. Francis Weber is one of the great French filmmakers who specializes in farce and sometimes social satire, but heavily laced with farce. And I saw him speak at the Directors Guild here in LA some years ago. And he was commenting on how you couldn't offend anybody. And so he finally found a group that could not be offended, idiots. And so he's made his most recent film. We saw The Dinner Game.
Yes.
The Dinner Game is a great movie.
I love that film. I love that film.
Well, of course, there's a good reason to.
Yeah.
And they remade it badly in Hollywood.
Terrible.
Yeah.
They called it Dinner for Schmucks.
Dinner for Schmucks.
Ugh. It was a terrible film. Great title.
Yes.
Yeah. Great title.
Yes. But that was his solution, was to make fun of imbeciles.
Well, I don't know. This is also true. I'm not making this up. I wanted to do a Goosebumps book called Morons from Mars. It's a great title, right? And my editor at Scholastic said, you can't do that. You'll offend the morons. And they wouldn't let me do that title.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
Well, you can't win, I guess.
No. It's just the worst time for anything. In the old days, talk about radio, the old radio days, every comedy show on radio, Jack Benny, Fred Allen, all these things, they had all these characters. There'd be a Russian guy who came in. There'd be an Italian guy. There'd be a Jew. There'd be a Russian. There'd be an Irish guy. Every week, they'd all walk. You couldn't do that today for anything. That's how far back we've come. You couldn't do a show like that now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I feel like the only way to have a life that is worth living is to be able to make fun of yourself. And if you can't make fun of yourself, then I worry for you.
Then who can you make fun of?
So your goal is to write funny stuff. And eventually you get hired by Scholastic. And because of your wife's success with her magazine, you get a chance to edit a similar or kindred magazine.
Yeah, right. Humor magazine.
So here is your opportunity, your golden opportunity. You are now getting a paycheck to write funny stuff.
True.
when did that left turn come along to doing scary stuff?
Well, the magazine ended and I was sent home from after many years at Scholastic. It was done. And one day, I'll tell you the whole story. I was doing freelance, all kinds of books, freelance books. I was writing bubblegum joke cards. I was doing coloring book. I mean, oh, anything. I can't ever say no to anything. Here I am here talking to you.
A prime example.
It's your own fault.
Yeah.
It's your own fault, Bob.
Right. So I was having lunch with Jean Fywell, who was the editorial director at Scholastic. And she came to lunch angry. She had had a fight with a guy who wrote young adult horror novels. And she was furious. I could name him, but I won't. Sometimes I do, but it's not nice. Christopher Pike. And she said, I'm never working with him again. I'll bet you could write a good teen horror novel. Go home and write a book called Blind Date. She gave me the title, and I honestly didn't know what she was talking about. What's a teen horror novel? I didn't know. I said, oh, sure, no problem. You've got it. You've got it. And I went running to the bookstore to see what was being written. What was teen horror? And I bought Christopher Pike books. And I bought Lois Duncan and Diane Ho and a bunch of other people. They were all writing teen horror. And I read them and I tried to figure out what I could do that would be a little bit different from their books. And I thought, you know, make it easier to read, make it a little younger, a little less nasty. And I wrote this book, Blind Date, and it came out. It was a number one bestseller. It's the number one book on Publishers Weekly.
Wow.
I'd never been near that list in my life. A year later, she asked me for another one. And I wrote a book called Twisted, another number one bestseller. And I thought, forget the funny stuff. Right? I'm going to be scared. I've been scary ever since. It's an embarrassing story because it wasn't my idea. It was her idea.
But you wrote it.
Yeah, but it wasn't my idea to write it or to be scary or anything. So anyway, I'm very grateful to her, of course. And I'm still doing books for Jean. She's at Macmillan now, and it hasn't been announced yet, so I shouldn't talk about it. But I'm doing a new series of scary short story books for Macmillan called Stein Tinglers. It's a good title, right?
It is.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, that's what I'm working on now, short stories.
Wow. Now, do you need us to cut that out, or are you allowed to say that?
No, everyone knows I'm totally indiscreet.
Okay.
You're just loose cannon.
You're just living up to your reputation.
That's right.
Yes, right.
I love that Stein tingle. It is so good.
This is true. So here's, Jane and I were thinking, why do one a year, one scary book a year? That's not enough. How can you do a scary teen horror series that would come out like monthly, or, you know, a series? And we thought, well, you can't have like the same two characters because that would be ludicrous. These horrible things happen to them month after month. And then we thought, well, what if there was a place? What if there was like a scary place where scary things happen? You could do that, and then you could have different characters and, you know, every time. And that's how we got the idea to do Fear Street, which would be one scary street in a very normal town, the town of Shadyside.
Right.
And people who lived on Fear Street, horrible things happened to them. Horrible. I don't know why they didn't move to Happy Street,
right.
Something, right? And I said, okay, this is true too. I don't know if it's interesting or not, but it's true. I sat down with a yellow pad. I thought, I've got to think of a good name for this series, a good name. And I said, I'm just going to sit here and take as long as it takes to think of a location, a place name for the series. And I wrote Fear Street. There it was.
It worked.
Yeah.
Again, you never broke a sweat.
That's right.
No.
Now, let me ask you, this is a fundamental question, which I'm sure you've only been asked a couple thousand times. But what distinguishes a teen or adolescent horror novel or scary novel from an adult scary novel?
The characters are all teenagers, mainly. There you go.
Okay.
And when we started out, they were much less violent and a lot fewer people died.
Mm-hmm.
But as it went on, we started killing more and more teenagers. People enjoyed that. People like to see teenagers. You know, did you see the Fear Street movies, the three movies?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. God, we killed dozens and dozens of kids, right? And people loved it. I actually saw a couple comments from I'm shocked by the Fear Street movies. I've never done anything R-rated before in my life. But I actually saw comments from people who said they weren't gory enough.
Oy.
How sick. How sick are people? Right?
Oh, my.
That's the series I want, is people coming up to you going, it wasn't gory enough. And you going, you need help. Yeah. You need medical assistance.
You do. Yeah, I know. But that's the main difference in the books. A lot of Stephen King plots would work just with, 16-year-olds.
Mm-hmm.
I've used many of his plots, believe me. Pet Sematary?
Yep.
That's my favorite. I think that's the scariest Stephen King book of them all. I've used that plot about six times.
It's fine. It's fine.
Yeah, it's too good. It's too good not to use.
Now, what and when was your first contact with either a television or a film adaptation of your work?
Well, I forget where it started. Goosebumps was enormous. It started in 92. By 94, I'm not bragging, we were selling 4 million books a month.
You were?
Just a statement of fact.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not really. No one more amazed than me, believe me. And they came to us. It was Fox Kids and YTV in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to do a Goosebumps TV series. And that was the first series that we ever did, which was, people don't realize, was a totally Canadian production. It was filmed at an old Molson Brewery in Toronto.
Doesn't get much more Canadian than that.
Yeah, that's right. And it was Canadian. We used every Canadian kid actor in the country. We used, you had to be Canadian. We used 11-year-old Ryan Gosling. He's in Say Cheese and Die. We used every Canadian.
Too funny.
And we had to, kids, I would do a book signing in this country. And kids would be in line and they'd say, how can I be on your show? I'm an actor. How can I be on the Goosebumps show? And I would say, well, you have to be Canadian.
And move to Canada.
Yeah, you have to be Canadian. And they would say, what's that? No one knew what a Canadian, that's a tribute to our school system. No one knew what a Canadian was. And do you know why? I mean, there are a couple of reasons why we shot. When we were doing Goosebumps, there were like 30 productions in Canada all being shot. There was another one called Are You Afraid of the Dark?
Which I watched. Yep.
Also done in Toronto. But we shot there mainly because they had no child labor law.
Oh, my
God.
And you could work the kids all night.
Jesus.
That's so funny.
None of the stuff about having a tutor on set, you know?
Oh, man.
Well, that's what is crazy. Yeah. It's true. In the 90s, you had Tales from the Crypt, Goosebumps, Are You Afraid of the Dark? All these horror series. And when I talk to, again, people my age, we still have nightmares about some of these shows that we watch. Are You Afraid of the Dark was terrifying.
Yeah, it was a lot of the same people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of the same actors and everything. Mm-hmm. I still get comments from kids saying, I can never babysit. I've never babysit. I can never, I'm terrified of masks. And kids who are afraid of that dummy, Slappy the Dummy. Slappy is like the star. You know, my books now are called Goosebumps Slappy World.
Really?
Because the dummy is so popular from the movies. And it's in my contract. Every other Goosebumps book has to be about Slappy the Dummy.
Jesus Christ.
Now, you chose to be an active participant in those shows. You could have just taken the check and gone to the bank, and as soon as it cleared, you know, go back home and, have a Molson's in the privacy of your residence in New York. But you chose to be a participant.
Well, I was I introduced the primetime shows.
Right.
Jane read every script. I didn't. Mm-hmm. She read every script. But I was the host of a lot of the shows.
Mm-hmm. And did you enjoy that role?
Well, I was overconfident. it gave me new respect for actors. And people who do those things. I'm, you know, a huge Rod Serling fan.
Of course.
He's a real hero of mine. So I love being there and introducing the shows. But I wasn't Rod Serling. In fact, the very first one was The Haunted Mask. And I would be standing in a mask store and I had these lines. And I'd say, hello, I'm R.L. Stein. I'm this. And I had the script on the plane flying to Toronto. And memorized the script and walked in and they said, well, let's do a run through. Do you want cards? Do you want us to hold up, you know, the cards? I said, I don't need that. I memorized it. I don't need that. Come on. I said, okay, let's do it. And I got in front of the camera. I got in place and I said, hello, I'm R.L. Stein. I was gone. That's all I had. It was completely gone. I was very overconfident. I've gotten better at it. It took me a long time.
Yeah.
I got better at it. I'm Mr. One Take now, but but yeah, I enjoyed it, you know.
Did you ever dream that you would be portrayed by an actor in a film, let alone a sequel?
Jack Black.
Yeah,
Jack.
I know.
Well, I wanted a really cool actor at that.
Yeah. I wanted Meryl Streep.
Well, that's fair.
Because she can do anything, right?
Right.
My friend Susan Orlean was played by Meryl Streep in The Orchid Thief, and the adaptation. But of course, I never dreamed of that, of all the crazy things. Sitting there, somebody's playing you. But, it took 23 years to get the Goosebumps movie going.
Yeah.
And the reason was they couldn't figure out which story to do. They didn't know which one to do. And then somebody had this idea to have R.L. Stein be a character and bring all the villains in at once. And then they could proceed with the script. And that's how it got going. Jack was great. He's a wonderful guy.
He is.
And I will tell you this, though. This is one of the meanest things my wife ever said. I have to warn you. Yes, you did. This is really cruel. A lot of people on Twitter and everything said, well, you should play yourself in the movie. Who knows you better than you? And I went to Jane. I said, you know, Jane, a lot of people think I should play myself in the Goosebumps movie. And she said, you're too old to play yourself.
Leave it to the wives.
Yeah, only a spouse could say that.
Yeah, and it was true. Of course it was true. Horrifying, horrifying. We're all too old to play ourselves, right?
That's right.
He was good. He flew into New York. I'd never met him.
Sure.
He flew into New York in a blizzard, actually, and we had lunch. And he just stared at me. Whole lot looking. And he said, Bob, what in the script is true about you? And I said, Jack, not a single thing. Nothing. He said, I'm going to play a sinister version of you. Mm-hmm. And that's what he did. But then somehow, when it came time to start filming, he had like this Orson Welles manner. Mm-hmm. I don't know where that came from. Mm-hmm. He was like Orson Welles suddenly. It's not, mm-hmm. you know, I'm from Ohio, right? I don't sound like Orson Welles.
Well, he was from Wisconsin, so, you know.
Yes. But we had a great time. He's a very generous guy. And just not manic like he is in the movies. Very
He's very,
and
very
he's
nice
a good
man.
Dad. We filmed in Atlanta, and he flew home to LA every weekend to see mm-hmm. his kids. That's really terrific.
Yeah, that's really terrific. He's lovely. He's a lovely guy. And how did the Netflix stuff come to be? The recent, all of the recent craziness.
The Fear Street. Oh my God! This is amazing to me.
Yeah.
It started about 2 or 3 years ago when Peter Chernin, who was at Fox back in the Goosebumps days, he was this young guy. And we even talked back, he was like in his 20s or something, about doing Fear Street back then. I bet he doesn't even remember that. But he bought the rights to do Fear Street movies. And he had this idea. I haven't written, you know, Fear Street a long time ago. I did about 80 of them. And then recently I've done 10 new ones recently. But he had this idea to do binge movie watching. And he would bring it out to movie theaters, one in June, July, and August, 3 months in a row. It would be like a horror summer. And you'd go to the theater 3 times. And see these films. And then, of course, COVID came and there were no movie theaters. And Fox, he did it for Fox, Peter, and Fox was bought by Disney, and Disney didn't want Fear Street. Mm-hmm. They didn't want it. They cut out a lot of films when they bought Fox.
Yeah.
And then we have the pandemic. There are no movie theaters. All three films were filmed. They were all done. Also in Atlanta. And he luckily sold it to Netflix. Netflix, one of them, and had this idea to do one a week, not one a month. And it's actually, I mean, this is a horrible thing to say probably, but thanks to the pandemic, it was this huge thing. I think if it had opened in movie theaters, it wouldn't be a big deal at all. Maybe people would have gone. But now all we do is watch Netflix every night, right?
That's right.
That's all we do.
That's right.
And there they were 3 weeks in a row on Netflix, and each one was like the number one film on Netflix.
Yep.
How so lucky.
Well, and they did some huge events here in LA. They did some really big events.
They did nice events. They did pop-up stores in LA and in London. The Netflix publicity machine. When you're used to book publicity,
right? Yeah.
movie publicity is like from another planet.
Yeah.
I did interviews for them in 4 countries. Try doing that on a book. You know, a book comes out. You're begging people, please write about it. Please, something. There were hundreds of interviews, hundreds, all the stars, hundreds of websites. All people want to talk about movies. They don't want to talk about books.
Mm-hmm.
We like you books. Know this.
Yeah, I know. It was amazing to me, just astounding. Well, and you know, what great luck.
Yeah.
Well, yes, luck, but always you deliver the goods.
Yeah.
It's lucky to have that opportunity and have that door open for you. But if you didn't give people what they want, they wouldn't have come back a second or a third week.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you. Yes, that's true.
Or 4 million books a month. Yeah.
Yeah, that was good. Those were the days. Yeah. Those were the days.
Now, you've been doing this long enough, Bob, that you've passed the generation line at least once. I don't know.
No, more than once. More than once. I get, my grandmother loves your book. I actually hate that, but
he gets it with his students. My grandma used to watch you on TV, and
I know.
Yeah, where's grandma right now?
You know,
I don't fight it.
Well, it was very hard to get used to being nostalgia.
Of course.
For a lot. No, I'm nostalgia for a lot of people.
Yeah.
That's hard to get used to, you know?
Yeah.
I would do a book signing. There'd be 7-year-olds and 10-year-olds and 25-year-olds and 30-year-olds. I would say, what are you doing here? Get out here. Go away. We loved you when we were kids. I got used to it. Got used to it.
Now, but being a smart guy, as you are, I've read that you seek out opportunities to talk to kids in the 21st century, to hear what they're saying, what they're thinking, to get a sense of the current mode of speech and all of that.
You have to keep up with them. Mm-hmm. That's a big part of the job, writing for kids.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to sound like Grandpa Walton trying to write. You got to, you know, it's got to seem real to them. The clothes has to be right. The hardest thing to keep up with is the technology, of course.
Of course.
Right.
Cell phones have ruined every mystery plot.
Yes. Well, and that's the thing I find so interesting. We talk about it with movies, that now almost every horror movie has to, at some point, there's no Wi-Fi here. We're in
you
the woods
get rid
and there's
of the
no
phone.
Service. Like, it's the first thing you have to do is remove technology
to
be able to then have a story.
Otherwise, they pick up their phone, they call, the story's over.
Yeah. The Uber comes and they leave. Yeah, it's...
Yeah, right.
This street looks scary. Let's go.
Yeah,
okay.
It is true. I mean, kids haven't changed, and our fears never change, right?
No.
We're all scared. I mean, Goosebumps could have been written in the 50s.
Of course.
It could have been. The only thing that's changed is the technology.
Yep.
I don't think there will ever be a time when there was an attic in your home that was, you know, the root of a long-term fear, a deep-rooted fear. Mm-hmm. What was up there? And you never found out.
Yeah, that's the mystery. You know, creaking sounds up there. That's all you need to be scared.
And that was true. That was true 200 years ago. Yeah. And it's true today.
And
that's right.
And what did my dad keep in our house that scared the crap out of me the entirety of my childhood into my teen years?
What?
Oh, I had a poster of Lon Chaney in clown makeup.
Laugh, clown, laugh.
Oh, wow.
And yeah. I'm not afraid of clowns. I have no issue with clowns. But this poster is effing terrifying. And he had it. It was the first thing when he walked into our house. And the piano room where I would practice piano, it was across from me. And it would look at me and it scared the crap out of me.
Oh, boy.
And I think when I was like 15 or something, you finally moved it to another place. So
it
I
took
didn't
him
have
15
to look
years?
At it all the time. He hates me, apparently.
Yeah, I don't get afraid of clowns. I have a couple of friends of mine are clowns. And they're the nicest people on earth.
It's not
just
the clown.
The sweetest people.
It's the face. If you see, I will have my dad send you a picture of this.
I can picture it. No, I know it. I know that poster.
His
I can
evil,
picture
evil
it.
Face.
Insert
staring.
Insert heavy sigh.
Look, man. Yeah.
Heavy parental sigh.
It was effing terrifying.
Yeah.
Kept it in the house.
In our house, we had a basement. And the basement had a workroom where the boiler was and other household equipment that I had no connection to. So that basement, which was dark, that was my scary place. And not terrifying, but always scary.
Mm-hmm.
And I never got past that. I thought at some point when I was an adult, you know, I could just turn
on. These childhood things stay with you.
Mm-hmm.
We had, in our basement, we had a freezer, a white porcelain freezer.
Mm-hmm.
And it was shaped like a coffin.
Oy.
It was long rectangle with a heavy black lid on the top. And my parents kept meat in it. And we kept musketeer bars.
Mm-hmm.
And it had, but mostly it had meat, you know, food. And every once in a while, my dad would say, go downstairs and bring up a roast, bring up some lamb chops. And I would go down in the basement and up to this freezer shaped like a coffin. And it, the lid, you raised it up, you raised up the lid. And I knew that one day there would be a body, a frozen Absolutely. Body stretched Absolutely. Out in this freezer. And I was doing a, you know, I do comedy clubs sometimes and just for something to fall back on. And I told this story, that, which is true, about the freezer. And then I said, and sure enough, one day I opened the lid and people guessed, they actually believed it. They believed there was a, I said, are you out of your mind? There was, they actually believed there was a body in the freezer.
Well, I think people, I think you believe what you sort of want to believe.
Yes.
And we're so manipulated by storytellers like you. So that it's a preconditioning. So if you've told us that that's what you fear, and you really and you know how to draw people in, as you're telling this anecdote, then I'm not surprised at all that
I was. who would believe
and one day I opened it and all of the Musketeer bars had been eaten.
Yes. Real horror story.
That's right. That's right.
Great.
Are you, I'm curious about, as a fellow writer, what your discipline is.
Hey, I'm cut out for this. It's like factory work. I'm sure. No, I just, you know, I'm just cut out to be home and working. So I have the same schedule every day. Jane says I'm like the dog. I do the same thing in the same order every day. And I sit down at the laptop in, at 10 in the morning and I write 2,000 words. And as soon as I hit 2,000, I quit wherever I am and get up. And then that's it. It takes like maybe 3 hours a day. Those are good hours.
Yeah. Right.
I work for maybe 10 to 1, 10 to 2 every day. And that's it. It's factory work.
Well, so you're, even if your well of ideas is flowing, you will cut it off.
I outline everything.
Ah, okay.
I have everything all planned. When I sit down to write a Goosebumps book or any book, I know everything that's going to happen in the book. Mm. I do like a 20-page outline for every book. And then the writing is so easy because I don't have to think. Uh-huh. I've done all the hard part. I've done all the thinking. You know, everyone hates to outline. Everyone hates it.
Oh, I always
But I can't. It. Yeah, every kids hate it. I can't work without it. Mm. That's one way you never have writer's block. Mm-hmm. I've done all the work before I start to write. You can't have writer's block. It's all there for you.
So interesting, isn't it? Everybody has what works for them. And apparently 7 million books later, it works for you.
Well, all we can do is say our collective hat is off to you.
Yes, the hat we collect is off to you.
You're very kind. You're very kind.
Not only your talent, but your longevity and your, and it's obvious, at least to me, and I think to Jesse, that you still enjoy mm-hmm. what you do. You still derive pleasure from what you do as much as the readers derive pleasure from reading it.
Yeah.
Thank you. No, it's really true. It's the best part of my day.
Yeah.
The working part. It's the best part.
Well, the joy for me is again, being a daughter of an author is when we go into bookstores and we see my dad's book, you know, that for me will always be one of the greatest things in the world. And every time I see Goosebumps, you know, or Fear Street or any of the different series, it makes me happy because you think, okay, kids are still going to be drawn to this and still want to read. And
it's a nice thing.
That in and of itself really is a big deal. And of course, to see them all over the world.
Yes. A you nice know, thing.
It's pretty damn cool.
Have you traveled and have you had
have you seen your book in different languages?
In your travels, yeah.
Yeah, we've had nice, you know, not recently, of course. Right. But I did a wonderful 5-city tour in China.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my.
We had a new Mandarin edition of Goosebumps. Wow. And it was like huge. This was like 9 years ago. And it was just wonderful. The kids were wonderful. It was just a great experience. And I did a week-long book fair in Brisbane, Australia. Mm-hmm. That was really nice. We loved that. That was good. And China I was recognized walking down the street in Paris.
Hey.
Recognized by a kid. Talk about highlights. That's a highlight.
Well, that would be cool.
Yeah.
Oh, my.
Right. Yeah, nice things, you know?
Yeah.
Once in a while, it's too nice. It is.
Oh. Well, Bob, we wish you continued success and continued enjoyment of what you do. And
you are a social media human, so people can find R.L. Stein on the various interwebs.
Yeah, I'm everywhere.
I'm everywhere.
And
so I keep up with you on Facebook.
Oh, well, that's nice. That's flattering to know.
Yeah, of course.
And thank you for making the time.
Mm-hmm.
This was so much fun. How great to finally be able to talk to you. Oh,
yes, exactly.
It was really a pleasure.
Wow.
Thank you for inviting me.
And Jesse, where are we?
You are at Leonard Maltin. I'm at Jesse Maltin on Instagram and Twitter. You are also on Facebook, as R.L. Stein pointed out. You can always go to leonardmaltin.com for movie reviews, book roundups, and all kinds of good stuff.
And last but certainly not least, we are on Patreon.
The Maltreon.
Which is patreon.com/maltinonmovies, the name of this show. patreon.com/maltinonmovies, where you can support what we do if you like what we do, and we can send you little goodies in return.
Mm-hmm.
So that's it for now. We'll see you guys next week.
Today's episode of Maltin on Movies is brought to you by Legion M, the world's first fan-owned entertainment company. If you love movies as much as we do, why not own a piece of them? Find out more at www.legionm.com.